All right, hey guys, welcome to the Inner Circle On Air. Today we have musician Steve Acho. Welcome to the studio, Steve.
Thank you, Mike. It's a beautiful studio.
Thank you. Thanks for coming in today.
Love it.
All right, so Steve, today we are going to cover all kinds of topics, starting with my keynote speech that I'm delivering in October this year.
That you're super excited about.
Yes, I'm super excited about that. Actually, public speaking is not my favorite thing to do. So in my industry...
You're in good company.
Yes.
Most people are that way.
In my industry, we have an international conference each year. I was selected to give the closing keynote alongside my mentee, Rex Sharkey, this year. And so each year I get out of my comfort zone with something new, and public speaking happens to be the one I'm going with this year.
Yeah.
So enter Steve Acho.
Yeah, and that's a tough one, by the way. There's been so many studies I've seen where people are more afraid of public speaking than they are of death. So Seinfeld has a joke that if you're at a funeral, most people would rather be in the casket than giving the eulogy.
Yeah.
That's how common it is. But so I commend you for going outside your comfort zone, because that
well,
is something
you.
That a lot of people have a hard time with.
I can tell you, getting out of my comfort zone a few years back, skydiving was the thing.
So and you did it.
I did it. And so I can tell you this, I would rather skydive than public speak. So that's a huge thing.
That would be me out of my comfort zone. I might need you there to kick my ass out of the plane. But yeah, that's awesome. But I mean, I think it's inspiring that you are so scared of doing that and that you're so committed to doing it. And, you know, you kind of brought me in to help you because I do keynote speeches and also coaching on all kinds of topics. And so, you know, I feel like you're somebody that some people that I coach, whether it's executives or whether I'm doing keynotes in front of companies or organizations, they're either looking to very quickly upskill or learn something new that they don't know how to do and become functional in it very quickly, or they're looking to just become much better at something that they know they want to do and they're already doing, but they want to really level up. And you know, you're obviously like experienced at this. You've spoken in front of people. You're articulate. You're smart. You know what you're doing. So I think you were kind of just looking for help in organizing and being inspired to be the best version of yourself. So
well, you have
amazing.
Such great stage presence. You know, you're a musician and you get up there, you do the thing, and you know, not only do you sing, perform, and do the coaching, you do micro business classes and help people level up personally and professionally, which
sure.
I think is great. And that's part of an ongoing process for me. It always has been, it always will be. And that's something important to me is always seeking out mentorship. And
mm-hmm.
so, you know, finding my way into the public speaking platform, it just seems like a good idea to, you know, seek out the best. And so I think that you have a lot to offer, and I'm looking forward to developing that stage presence and that level of professional speaking, you know.
Yeah. Well, one of the things we talked about that I think is that we both have in common is even though we can perform and be in front of people and we're not super uncomfortable with the spotlight, but we're certainly not seeking it, is this idea of, it's not even imposter syndrome so much where it's like, who am I to be saying this? Like for the things that we have some credibility and expertise in, we're fine. You know, we could write it and people would read it and go, oh yeah, I learned something. But to be on stage and do it just seems a little bit like self-absorbed or something.
Mm-hmm.
And so it seems like self-promotion. And one of the things that helped me get over that was this psychologist, Adam Grant, who's just phenomenal. Like every one of his little meme quotes is just a mic drop line. It's not a silly, you know, rainbow meme that says, believe in yourself, rah, rah. It's like something very actionable. And a concept that I learned from him is that he wrote this book and some of his colleagues that are other professors gave him feedback. And one of them said, love the book, hate the self-promotion. And, you know, he's like us. He's a humble guy. He's very smart. He has lots of things to share that are useful for the world. And he kind of sat on this for a little while. And he came up with this concept of it's not self-promotion, it's idea promotion. It's almost like not who am I to say this because look at me. It has nothing to do with that. It's who am I to not share these ideas that could be helpful to humanity? Who am I to keep that in and mm-hmm. not say it? And if I can be on stage, I don't have to be performing, I don't have to be a clown, I don't have to, you know, like have the spotlight on me, that's not really the point. But the point is we're sharing ideas. And so if I can do that through concepts or jokes or, you know, something in my keynote routine or examples or bringing people up on stage and showing them why thinking a certain way is ridiculous and, you know, kind of make people feel the things that we already know, but we don't feel in our body. Like one example that just came to mind is most people will agree that multitasking is not a good idea, right? But I do an exercise where you feel in your body what it's like to multitask. Mm-hmm. And then the difference between that and what it feels like to actually focus on anything, something, to the exclusion of everything else for 5 minutes. And it's something like that that I think humans have bad intuitions about. And that's one of them. I think we underestimate our own capability to very quickly upgrade our skills in something literally in 5 to 10 minutes. 5 to 10 focused minutes, mm-hmm. not 5 to 10 minutes with the TV on, having a half conversation, texting your friend, but just 5 minutes of that we don't get a lot of practice at unless we actually, you know, set it aside and do it.
Yeah, undistracted.
Right.
I like that.
So the idea of you know, you getting up on stage and sharing your wisdom with people, we both had to get over the kind of like, I don't want the spotlight and, you know, I don't want to promote myself. But ever since I started thinking about it differently, I'm just thinking of sharing ideas. Even if I write a song, right? Because it seems kind of self-absorbed to be like, hey, everybody, I wrote a song. Here's me in a video playing a song. I hope you like it. It just feels like, hey, everyone, look at me. But really, if it's
gifts.
A funny song and it makes people laugh, like, awesome. If it's a song that makes them, it's profound and it makes them think and it evokes some positive emotion, who am I to hold that back?
I like that perspective, right? And you opened up my eyes to that. When you explained, you know, you have gifts to share, and when you have wisdom or experience to share with on a large platform, that it's, you know, your responsibility to do that. And it's not self-promotion.
Right.
You're helping others promote themselves.
Exactly. Inspiring others.
Yes.
And not just, I mean, a lot of the stuff that I do is very kind of, I would say, practical wisdom. Mm-hmm. It's not just like, here's a concept that I can say out loud and everyone will agree with and applaud and then go home and make no changes.
Right? Yeah.
Like
implementation is key.
Exactly.
You're
not going to implement something. I mean, to me, I think one of the kind of silver bullets of my spiel or my keynote or coaching or whatever is that when you're learning to do something, people think, well, how do you stay motivated, right? And the word motivated is kind of, I don't know, there's baggage for me there, right? Because you can watch like Tony Robbins jump up and down on stage. You can watch one of your heroes. You can be motivated by, you know, your father saying, I'm proud of you and, you know, I'm behind you. Whatever it is, that isn't sustainable. But what is sustainable is intrinsic motivation. Okay, so how do you stay intrinsically motivated? Well, there's the obvious one that's now the zeitgeist now, which is Simon Sinek's Find Your Why, right? Mm-hmm. If you know your why, then you can pretty much withstand any what, because you're going to fight for this why, because the why is bigger than you. But I think you'll also give up if you don't feel like you're making progress. And that's what I look at as when people say they want to be happy. Happy is a word that's just so vague,
right?
As to be, like, you can be happy with a glass of wine, but that doesn't mean you're a happy person, right? I think what we mean is fulfillment.
Right.
And I think at least one definition of fulfillment is progress, right? Just that feeling that I'm a better human or father or husband or brother or sister or whatever I am, like business person, employee, boss, this month than I was last month. If I just feel that, then I feel like I'm making some progress. And I heard someone say, if you're not almost embarrassed by who you were 10 years ago, then you're not really working hard enough, right?
That's right.
I'm definitely embarrassed, so I think I'm doing the work. But that's kind of how I define it. And so the concepts that I try and get across, whether I'm teaching someone how to play a musical instrument for the first time, is what do you want to do? Like, you want to learn to play the guitar. What does that mean? How will you know when you're done? Well, really what I want to do is I want to pick up an acoustic and sit around my buddies in a campfire and play songs that I'll sing along to. Okay, great. All right. So just know that if you learn 4 or 5 chords, like just positions on the guitar, you'll know 200 songs. So let's get you to do that.
Yeah.
And how quickly will you be able to do that? Literally in an hour, you'll be able to, like, I picked up a ukulele for the first time in my life, and 15 minutes later I was playing songs.
Amazing.
But anyone can do it, I think, or most people. I mean, I might have started out with a better ear or something like that,
sure.
But certainly not better dexterity or anything like that, right? I'd never touched it, and I've never touched a violin, but I know if I wanted to be good at that, I know what to do. And really the hack is to get to the closer to doing the thing that you want to be able to do
mm-hmm.
faster.
Yeah.
Even if it's considered kind of irresponsible. Like to teach someone piano, it's probably responsible to spend 45 minutes teaching them how to sit, right? And how to put their hands, and then to explain music theory, and then, you know, to tell them how the fingering goes, and then, you know, all these, and then to explain the attributes of music, right? There's timing and tempo, there's fingering, there's all these different attributes, right? Just like there's attributes to sports, like swimming.
Mm-hmm.
You have to be, you know, if you have really good cardio, you have to be flexible, you have to be strong, you have to be all these things, right? But get in the water,
yeah.
Right? Like, play the piano. If you want to learn how to play some song, like, you will leave, if I were giving piano lessons, like, you would leave my house playing Let It Be, for example.
Yeah.
And now, even if it's not great, you're not 6 months away from playing a song because you're focusing on the attributes, right? The attributes are timing and rhythm and where you put your hands and everything else. Why not just do the thing you want to do and learn the attributes by doing the thing you want to do? And then you'll feel progress. So that sounds to some people who teach music, or I have a way of teaching foreign language, like second language acquisition. It sounds almost irresponsible to approach it that way. Like, mm-hmm. hey, let's just get right into, hi, my name is Steve, and I'm a international consultant. And like, that's probably year three for learning German or Japanese or something, right? Yeah, but you're actually going to say it. So why not learn that and learn the grammar and learn the pronunciation and learn the attributes of music? And then, or of language, and then guess what? You have a conversation with someone in a week, and you know how to introduce yourself and say this complex thing. And then they ask you a question, and you don't know it, but next time you're going to know, and it's going to be reinforced, right? So people look at that and they say, it's irresponsible. You got to start with this, and you got to teach them how to write it, and you got to teach them the history of why the vowels are this way. And it's like, that's fine if people stick with it.
Right.
90% of people don't. So
and
would you rather have someone stick piece it? That absolutely, yeah. So people learn differently. And some people might learn better that way. But I think the average person, I think what everyone has in common is that they're much more likely to quit doing what they're doing if they don't feel like they're making progress.
Absolutely.
Right?
They say in jiu-jitsu, most folks fall out after blue belt.
Yeah.
You know,
right.
That's a common.
You just start getting to understand what you're doing and when you're in a good and bad position, and then you're just getting smashed everywhere and you're like, oh, I'm not getting any better.
Yeah.
So tough. Yeah.
And the jiu-jitsu connection, our audience doesn't know. Steve
is
a brown belt in jiu-jitsu. So we have that in common.
Yeah.
I'm not a brown belt, but we have jiu-jitsu
for
in
sure.
common. But all principles apply.
Absolutely.
But to your point, I think consistency and implementation, you know, with the foreign language, you speak fluent Japanese, which I think is an interesting language, and say more about that.
Yeah, sure. Well, I got into martial art at a very young age, and I just thought that, I don't know, at some age I was into Bruce Lee, and, you know, everything Asian was cool to me. So our high school in Birmingham, Michigan was one of the first five, I think, in the state to have Japanese offered at the school, and there were five or six of us in the class. So I did 2 years of that. And then I went to Japan for the first time with my karate instructor, and I realized that high school Spanish and French and Japanese and whatever are not the way that it's spoken on the street.
Right.
It's just, it doesn't prepare you. Like, even the way that they teach English to foreigners and even to us is really more like algebra. It's like, well, here's where the preposition goes, and here's a prepositional phrase, and they're teaching us how you're supposed to talk, right? But the way that people actually talk, like, you have to be in the mix of, right? So I realized fairly quickly that either I was really bad at this, which I didn't believe because I actually have a decent ear, which just means I know when I'm doing it right or wrong, so I can get better. and I applied it to music. So I took that kind of the same principle of like, what do you want to be able to do? I want to be able to have a 5-minute conversation. Okay, well, why take this Japanese textbook that's this thick and learn a new word every day that's out of context? How much is the ashtray? Today is Wednesday. You know, I enjoy onions. Like, what are the odds
you're
I'm going to have to say that
from
in
a dictionary.
The next? Yeah, exactly. Like flashcards. Yeah. And then the odds that I'm going to hear any of that stuff are very low, right?
Yeah.
So I kind of applied this 80-20 principle to my own learning. I got a tutor and I said, look, first I want to be able to introduce myself and have a 5-minute conversation with pretty much any Japanese person. Like, meeting someone in any language is scripted, right? I mean, we know it's like, hi, my name's Steve, and mm-hmm. you know, where are you from? Like, be able to ask and answer the same questions. You already know if you go to a wedding and you're meeting everyone at your table, you're doing it 10 times. We all do it.
Yeah.
So, wow, like, that's going to repeat every single time you go out on the street and speak to someone in Japanese. I should be really good at that. Okay, then what's next? Okay, like, what are your hobbies? I play tennis. Oh, I play tennis. I grew up playing tennis. Where do you play? How long have you been playing for? So now that's part of your arsenal, but your arsenal is going to be reinforced because you're always meeting people and you're always having conversation. So then fast forward and now you're doing work and you're doing work with people in this manufacturing environment or this tech environment. There's certain words and phrases and things that are going to repeat. So it's like there is no Japanese for everyone. There is no Japanese for busy people. There's no Japanese for this or that. It's like we're all a persona,
yeah.
right? So when I lived in Japan, I was like, you know, in my late 20s, I was a single guy. I played music, I did martial art, and I worked at Mazda. I worked for the president of Mazda and was mostly in a manufacturing facility. That's a persona.
Yeah.
There aren't 50 other people like me that did that, probably, mm-hmm. right? Like, there's probably no other American weirdo like me who's doing that anywhere in Japan. So
right.
I'm fairly unique, but so is the lady that lives next door who's an American, whose husband works for Mazda, mm-hmm. and she's taking her kids to school every day and has to interact somehow with a Japanese teacher, and then she's going to play tennis with her friends, and then maybe she takes an Ikebana class or something, right? So she's we are exposed to still Japanese, right? But kind of a different environment where she would have a hard time in mine,
yeah.
and I would really have to adapt to hers to understand
sure.
that. But hers is going to be reinforced because she knows all of the words and the vocabulary, and the rest of the language seeps in, right?
Mm-hmm.
So you don't have to have a flashcard for the word tomorrow.
Right.
She's going to hear it when they say, there's no school tomorrow because it's a holiday. I'm not going to hear that word because I'm not in school and I don't have kids in school. But what I am going to hear is all the stuff that has to do with music, all the stuff, you know, my life. So you build this persona. You start with introducing yourself, which
right.
is the very first thing that happens between humans. And then based on your friendships or your business relationship or your hobbies, you start getting into that. So what are you have these inputs and outputs, right? What are people likely to say when you say I play tennis, right? Like, what are the inputs and outputs? How long have you been playing? Did you play in college? Have you always played? Do you like singles or doubles? Like, what kind of racket do you use? Where do you play? And then I ask that of the other person. And then, like, would you like to play sometime? Like, all these things are fairly predictable.
Mm-hmm.
So why go to a generic book that's teaching you the word Wednesday?
Exactly.
When you can learn the word Wednesday when someone says, let's play tennis on Wednesday. And you say, I don't know that word. But then you learn it. And guess what? You're probably going to hear it again.
Yeah.
Both tennis and Wednesday you're going to hear, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that's going to be unique to that person, and I'm going to have my own kind of flow of learning. But the overall point is that what stops people from being motivated to continue is when they don't feel like they're making progress.
Right.
And so kind of the cartoon example that I use, that's true, but it makes it so obvious for everyone when I say this. So some, you know, 90% of people on January 1st make a New Year's resolution to lose weight,
mm-hmm.
right?
It's a big one.
So we know that, right?
Yeah.
It's a big one. So I believe that most people, probably 90% of people, when they say, I want to lose weight, that's not what they mean.
Mm-hmm.
They mean, I want to get rid of my beer belly. I want to swap some of this fat for lean muscle. I want to look great in a bikini. I want to feel better. I want to fit into my high school jeans, like
mm-hmm.
on and on. They mean something else,
sure.
right? So own that. And the reason it's important to own that is because I have this great slide, this before and after picture, right? Now, you've seen a million before and after pictures, right?
Yep.
I mean, it just, they don't even look like the same person. It's like the guy on the left looks like he ate the guy on the right.
Total transformation.
Complete, right?
Yep.
So there's this amazing 12-week transformation of this woman. And what's amazing about it is not the transformation itself, but one, the fact that it happened in 12 weeks, and two, the fact that in the before picture, she weighed 135 pounds, and in the after picture, she weighed 135 pounds.
Interesting.
Right?
Yeah.
And so, you know, like muscle weighs more than fat, sure, and blah, blah, blah. And not that everyone needs to be all, like, have that same goal that she had.
Right.
But the point here is that if you say, I want to lose weight, if that person, she didn't, but if she had said, I want to lose weight, and then she just went on this hardcore nutrition and exercise regimen that was like took all that discipline, and then 3 weeks later she weighed herself, what's she going to say? I'm not losing weight. Didn't work. I give up. I mean, I would too if that were the goal, but that's not the goal.
Right.
Right? So to be really clear on what that is so important, because then you can find the 80-20 of, okay, I want to get to here. It's not, I want to play guitar. It's, right, I want to bang out some songs. Well, my friends and I sing along. I don't want to be on stage in New York necessarily. If you do, that's a different path, and
that's
fine.
You have to find your deep inside why.
Exactly. Yeah. The why and the exactly what it is that you want. And then you'll know when you're moving towards that, you'll feel like you're making progress. But the example there I just bring up to say, if she were to mistakenly say, I want to lose weight, when that's not really what she meant, mm-hmm, she would have quit. We never would have seen those pictures,
right,
but she didn't. She said, I want to transform my body so that I fit into these clothes,
yeah,
and so that I look great in a bikini for summer. That's what she said.
Yep.
And so she had clothes that she couldn't fit into, and she took front, side, back pictures in a bikini and then set it aside, and then 3 weeks later did the same thing, mm-hmm, and was like, progress.
Yeah. Consistency.
That's motivation.
Yes.
Not me saying, you can do it. Yay. Here's a rainbow. Believe in yourself.
Yeah.
If you think you can or you think you can't, you know, all the like the kind of cliche,
yep,
motivational things, right? Not that there's anything wrong with those. It's
I
just
agree.
They're not intrinsic,
sure,
motivation. And so they give you sparks of like, I'm going to try again. But in the end, if you try something and you don't feel like you're better after a lot of trying, that's not a lot of motivation.
It's like jujitsu. I can
really
relate
is.
Everything back to jujitsu in my
everything.
Life. And
yeah.
It's, I was training 3 times a day.
Yeah.
You know, because I wasn't picking up as fast, but I was really committed to wanting to learn because,
yeah,
I wanted to get better. I knew that, that I had a place there. And so it was just finding the right training partners,
yeah,
and kind of customizing my routine. But, mm-hmm, that meant me training 3 times a day,
yeah,
morning, noon, and night.
That's awesome.
So I did that and I got really good. So, I mean,
that's
I filled
awesome.
Out my card and I progressed and,
yeah,
you know, I found my way into that. But it's the same with anything that I take a deep dive into, whether it be skydiving. That was, you know, a fear I was looking at facing. And I got in there.
I love
then,
that, too, that you do that. You don't just say, I'm afraid of skydiving, so I'm going to go skydiving. Like, you get into it.
And then commit.
You're, like,
continue to
obsessive.
Do the thing.
And
it's
I mean that
a
as a compliment.
Time. Thank
you're
you.
Like,
I appreciate that.
Like, that's amazing.
It's the same with public speaking. So that platform, it's like, I like, you know, when I come across a fellow lunatic like yourself, it's like,
well,
you
said.
Know, gotta have a little bit of crazy in you to continue
right.
on, you know?
Right.
So, I like taking that risk, in developing myself, you know, whether I'm good at it in the beginning or not is here nor there to me because I know I'll get there.
Yeah.
And so I appreciate that about you is that, mm-hmm. you know, it's, your deep dive into Japanese mm-hmm. and your journey into that language.
Yeah.
And now you teach it.
Yeah, I mean, when I was in, I actually worked my way through college, I was doing interpreting and translating. So I would drive across the street from Oakland University to Takata, and they would have faxes at the time, and they were sent from Japan, and the engineers that got them didn't even know which end to
wow.
hold up. So I was just writing in pencil, and they were paying me $30 an hour as a, you know, 20-year-old. I mean, that was...
Translator.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
That's insane. That was amazing. And so I just got into that, and then eventually I got into business, and it was like, look, Japanese language and culture is hard. We can teach you the business.
Yeah.
And then I got into that and start, you know, was in the auto industry. And
it's amazing. Yeah. You've authored books.
Yeah, a couple.
And so how
yeah.
many do you have under your belt now?
I published 2. The first one was actually on that topic. It was called, it's called The Least You Need to Know About Doing Business with the Japanese. And it came from me doing this at universities and then doing it for corporations. And I would do these these seminars for usually Japanese companies that had a lot of American employees or that had, you know, people transplants here that were from Japan. And it had Americans, Europeans, you know, Westerners basically working with Japanese. And even though the Japanese spoke English very well, most of them, there's still a barrier. There's still a cultural barrier that it's not easy to understand without knowing the language and the culture and how intertwined they are. So I kind of made it my goal to demystify all of that stuff. Mm-hmm. And I ended up working for this CEO that was like, look, I don't have 2 days to have all of my managing directors from all over the country come in and, like, you know, give me the least I need to know in 4 hours. Mm-hmm. And I was like, first of all, yeah, for sure, I can do that. I love that idea. But second of all, what a great name, the least you need to know. Yeah. Like, what is the least you need to know? Like, I should have a 3x5 card version of that. And so now I've done that version of executive coaching for people at Toyota or other companies, not necessarily teaching them the language. If they want to learn the language, I'll tell them what I think they should do and the path they should be on with the instructor that, you know, the company gives them, the, mm-hmm. the kind of how-to. I'm not going to stand in front of them and teach them the language, but I can tell them what to do to get there a lot faster. But it's mostly like understanding from a high level, what is culture? What are the aspects of your culture and the target culture that are drastically different, right? But that you can't see. You can't see my assumptions, my beliefs, my thoughts about women in the workplace. You can't know that about what I'm thinking.
Right.
You can maybe see it in my actions, right? But most of culture is like an iceberg. It's underneath. So you have to know what's underneath. You have to know that most Americans, not all, are very individualistic. Like, I'm dressing like this and acting like this because people like me do things like this. Whatever mm-hmm. version that is in my head, that's what I'm trying to be consistent with. And most people in Asia, especially in Japan, are really trying to be part of a group. Like, that is a compliment to say, right. Steve, you're dressed just like so-and-so. Like, that might be an insult in America. In Japan, it's like, thank you. Yes, I'm trying to be part of that group, right?
Yeah.
So to understand the aspects of how people think and then how the behavior is output into the world and then the consequences of, like, why cultural misunderstandings occur in the first place and then what to do about it.
Right.
Right? So then you have all this knowledge, and then when I give you the actual tactic, so I'll bring one up as an example. When you give a business card to someone, you hold it with two hands facing them and you kind of bow down a little bit and you treat it like almost like it's a gift. It's not just your contact info. And then they give it to you. And if you're holding stuff in your hands, like, you should put it down and actually take it with two hands and go like this and not put it away. Don't shove it in your pocket. Right.
Right?
Now, Americans can get away with that because, you know, whatever, we're barbarians and we don't know any better. But if you know the why behind that, it makes that interaction understandable. It's
right.
not just a list of do's and don'ts that you have to memorize. So I condensed all that into the least you need to know, because I love how that CEO said it. And I was like, okay, the least you need to know, like, if I could tell you everything that I think is the 80-20 of it, you should be able to read it on a flight from Japan, but before you get to your layover in New York.
Yeah.
Like, that's my goal. And that's what it was. That's what it is.
I love that.
So, yeah.
Isn't it interesting how something can inspire you? Just
exactly.
one sentence.
Just a word. Just something someone said.
Spark something. Like,
that's brilliant. Like,
I love
like
that.
What do you think? I actually thought about this conceptually because at the time they had the Idiot's Guide and the dummy, what was it, for dummies? Like, you know, computer networking
for dummies.
For dummies,
yeah, everything
for dummies, right?
Yes.
So I thought, what about the least you need to know about?
Yeah.
Whatever, pick your topic,
yeah.
right? The least you need to know about managing your finances. Like, mm-hmm. that's a pretty good life skill that we don't necessarily get K-12,
or right.
maybe they do now, right? So anyway, I never did it,
yeah.
but I like the idea so much because it's like, what's the minimum viable
Simplify
stuff you need
people.
To know?
People are busy.
Yeah. yeah, well, and not just that. It's not just busy that they won't read the book. It's busy that, like, it's either a one or a zero sometimes,
yeah.
right?
right.
It's like, I'm not gonna, like, you want me to learn algebra, it's too much.
Right.
But if you tell me, these are the most practical ways that you're gonna have to use, like, the fundamentals of math in your daily life. Maybe you have a mortgage, you're probably gonna need to manage your own finances. Maybe you wanna invest. Like, like use practical math. This is the least you need to know. Yeah. So anyways, so you guys are welcome to use that. And
now, where can they pick that book up at?
So that all my books are published on Amazon. So well, I say all. That's one of them. The other one is on recruiting. So I have a tech staffing company, and I wrote one called Why Technology Recruiting is Broken and What to Do About It. And it's just divided into two halves, me ripping on the recruiting industry.
Yeah.
And then me saying, here's how what I think we could do to be better. And basically, I wrote it because I wanted to make a dent in the industry by using technology to be more human, not as an excuse to be less human. So I hope I'm somehow making that dent.
Well, that's amazing. Yeah, that's some great accomplishments there.
Thank you.
I like that. So that was, we'd covered two books, right?
Yep.
You have another?
I started writing another, and then it just became the keynote speech that I do.
Got it.
It's called The Progress Promise. And it's kind of, you know, it's rapid learning, it's simplified goal achievement, it's applying 80-20 principles to simplify complex things, right? And so take the example that I gave of, like, don't say you want to lose weight if you really mean you want to fit into high school jeans.
Yeah.
That's step one. Then step two is, like, what's the 80-20? Like, what are the few most important things you need to do versus the trivial many that will get you there? Then the next step is to focus. And that's where we said, like, no multitasking, like, do right. this even for 10 minutes. You will see, you will feel in your body that you are improving at this skill or you're becoming a different person, right? And then experiment. So it's kind of this framework. And then I apply it to, you know, that's one example, but I apply it to learning music. I apply it to learning a foreign language. I apply it to every aspect of business, hiring the right person the first time.
Yeah.
Right? Like, how to do that and use the same exact framework.
I like that.
So that's why I call myself a proud professional hack. I don't know if that's good or bad, but I don't know how many people are sitting around going, I need a hack. Does anyone know a good hack?
But everyone's looking for
that. That's kind
of
what it is. Yes. Yeah.
Right.
Right.
But no shortcuts. I mean, it's a hack, but without shortcuts, because you really do have to put in the dedication and the work.
For sure.
And I think that, you know, just even getting back to any kind of self-improvement, your overall commitment needs to be to your health and wellness, first and foremost. And then you take the deep dive in, and then the rest is, you know, sheer dedication.
Everything else is a side effect of that, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Truly, that was my journey into fitness. I was trying to correct a back issue that led to six-pack abs.
Yeah, and I was like, going to say, it was like, here you are with six-pack abs.
Like, initially, right. That was not my goal.
It's just a happy side effect.
I wanted to feel better,
right.
And I did not want to experience back pain anymore.
Yeah.
And that just really led to core strength, which, you know, I didn't realize that when I was, you know, in my early 20s and I had the initial back injury.
Sure.
I was focused on back muscles, which was further injuring me, know, until I started working alongside somebody that turned me on to core strength. And then it was just, you know, the aesthetics were a bonus after.
Right.
And so that's just gravy, you know, so to speak.
That's
so
great. Yeah. Well, I like what you said about how you still have to be dedicated, because it's true. There are hacks, but that for me, the way that I use the word hack is really to keep you inspired to make improvements.
Mm-hmm.
But the honest truth is that to be successful at anything, it isn't like a hardcore sprint 20 hours a night this week and then you're gonna be an overnight success. It really is, unfortunately, this is unsexy to say, but it's just repeating mundane, ordinary things.
Oh, you're right.
All the time for a really long period of time. That's the truth, but how do you get to that if you quit in 2 weeks? That's the thing. So that's what I'm dealing with, is the one or the zero. It's like, it's not the person who says, like, oh, I'm not the best piano player in the world. It's like, yeah, but you were not going to play piano before.
Right.
Like, do you want to play piano or not? If you want to be able to do it, like, you can be inspired to start doing it and then leave that first lesson and go, wow, I'm actually playing piano.
Yeah.
Right? Whereas, you know, you could take, I always joke with my sister, like, she took 4 years of high school French, and then she went to Paris, and I'm pretty sure all she knew how to say is, how is Monique, or whatever.
That is funny, you know? Because I, high school French, I can say the Pledge of Allegiance in French.
Oh,
that's
nice.
It.
So that, I mean, that's kind of it. Like, that's the joke, in a way, is that, imagine you being at a party, and I meet a French person, I'm like, hey, my buddy Mike speaks French, and then you rattle off the Pledge of Allegiance, they're going to be like, great, you know?
Yeah.
And to me, that's the same image that I get when someone says, oh, you play the piano. Mm-hmm. And I go, yeah. And then I take a book and I start going like this. There's nothing wrong with that. Yeah. That is a skill
sure.
that actually I admire. I don't have, and I admire that. But it's still not expressing yourself in a way where you're communicating your thoughts to someone. You're basically saying like, oh, you speak English? Go ahead. And then I go, yeah, 4 score and 7 years ago. It's like, how long is this conversation going to be? You're just rattling things right. off that someone else said. And you're saying it perfectly. Good for you. That's a skill. Your pronunciation is great. But like, I want to get to know you, mm-hmm. right? So I wanted to sit down and be like, I'm going to be able to play a song by ear. I'm going to play a sad song. I'm going to start jamming in the blues. I don't even know what that means yet, but that's what I'm going to be able to do. And then I took the path kind of you know, least resistance yep. and quickest feeling of progress, right? And that's what it is.
I think you're, to your point of the mundane, it's a bit of a hamster wheel sometimes when yeah. you're committed to the thing, sure. whether it be diet and exercise. I mean, mm-hmm. My first, as I started improving my back strength and working on my core and the other aesthetics bonuses that I was receiving along the way, you know, my diet
changed.
That keeps
you motivated, right?
Yeah, it kept me motivated. Yeah. And then it gave me...
And your diet changed. So it's an upward spiral.
Which can be a little bit of a hamster wheel with that. So it was a lot of you work out and yeah. I'm sure you eat clean too. And when you're doing that, it's a lot of chicken and broccoli yeah. and things like that, fish yeah. and, you know, clean eating. But it's a lot of the same thing,
yeah.
you know. And I actually enjoy that, though.
Right.
That's not something that I, you know, that bothers me.
Me neither. So, no. I love food, so I'm going to have the stuff you mentioned,
yeah.
but not if it tastes like garbage.
Right, exactly.
That's my only drug, so.
People are always disgusted by my love for green juice. I love green yeah. juice. I love wheatgrass.
Oh,
I love
nice.
The taste of that
I can't
stuff.
Do wheatgrass. I feel
oh,
like
my God, it's
I just got tackled on the football field. I don't know how you do that, but oh, I know it's healthy. I wish I did like it.
It's delicious, but yeah. no, I wouldn't yeah. put anything in there. And back... Mm. Back in my younger years when I used to drink heavily, just with that group.
Not wheatgrass, I assume.
No, when I was running with that group, I would drink some of the most disgusting liquors, yeah. you know, and I'm flashing back thinking right. like, good Lord, if I could drink that stuff back then, why can't I drink something that tastes good, that, you know, that's good for my body? So I always yeah. associate it back to something like that when it comes to wheatgrass.
Yeah.
And there's a little bit of an adjustment curve, I suppose, too, when you get into something like that where it's like your taste buds are new to these
right.
things, you
right.
know? So
yeah,
you
got to sure.
give it a chance also,
yeah.
you know? Tell me how you got involved in music.
I've always loved music since I was a little kid. My mom played the records at home, and I would sing along to them, and... probably 7 years old, and I saw my cousin play and sing a Beatles song on the piano, and I just thought that was the coolest thing ever. So I convinced my mom. I mean, I just thought, I want to do that. Like, that is cool.
Yeah.
So I convinced my mom to sign me up for a Super Saturday class. So I was ready to skip cartoons for 10 weeks. And first day I show up, there's probably 25 people. I was the youngest by far. I'm 7 years old. First music class. And we spent 40 minutes with the instructor, who's very accomplished, by the way, classical pianist. I didn't know what that meant. And he kind of started going over probably the responsible thing when you're starting out, you know, people are starting out at music, just music theory and chord progressions and major and minor scales and things that all sounded like, you know, Greek or some
Japanese.
Form of trigonometry to yeah. me, right, at the time, like it was over my head. But it was so much of the hour, and then finally 40 minutes in, we get to sitting. And I don't think we ever played any notes, right? So it just, I was almost in tears. I mean, I'm this kid there, and I felt like overwhelmed because, first of all, it seemed like I just wasn't smart enough to get it. And then you couple that with, I feel like everyone else does, so mm-hmm. I'm just an idiot. I mean, I don't know if that's true or not that they did, but I was a younger one, but I just thought like, okay, everyone's moved on to algebra and I'm still not understanding addition and subtraction. Like, I shouldn't be in here. Like, I was almost in tears. So that was my first and last music class. And so I just had this self-limiting belief for a decade, starting at 7 years old, that I was just not smart enough to understand music. And I certainly was not, you know, talented enough to be able to do it. And that was in my head, and that was reinforced many times. I remember being in middle school and being one of the 10% of the people that tried out for the glee club singing and didn't make it.
Yeah.
Right? So look at me now, right? But anyways, I'm kidding.
That's a great story.
So when I'm 17, and I'm still kind of in this, you know, I'm bad at music, but I love music thing. My parents took my sister and I to our first concert. I think I was 16, 17, and we went and saw Billy Joel. And I mean, it was the coolest thing. He was standing up and playing the piano and playing with one hand and pointing. I mean, it was just the coolest thing I ever saw. And we had a piano at home. My sister took lessons and hated it. So we had this Billy Joel record. Remember those?
Oh, yeah. So we've got some vinyl around.
Played the records, and I sat there and just obsessed and played by ear, which I still do. I still haven't taken that 7-year-old, that was the first and last music class I ever took. So I never learned to read. I have a good ear. That's the one, I think, thing that I was born with. It's not musical or nothing to do with foreign language or whatever. I just have a good ear, mm-hmm. which means I can tell when I'm singing out of key and I can tell when I'm playing the wrong notes. So I figured out what the right notes were, and I just started playing with 3 fingers and 4 and 5 and then just started playing. And I went to a friend of mine who is still a good friend and still one of the smartest people I know, and he had a recording studio in his basement, which in 1988 is like saying I have a flying machine coming over. And I had written a song that I was really nervous about, and so he said, that's pretty good, I'm gonna play guitar on it. What key are you in? And I was like, I don't know what you mean. And he's like, what chords are you playing? And I'm like, I don't know what a chord is. And he's like, wow, you really don't know anything, do you? He's like, all right, let's record this song and then I'll show you. So we do the song, and then he's like, this is a chord chart. Like, you're making things way too... I told him about the class that I took.
Yeah.
And I was like, I know I'm not smart enough to get this, so probably don't explain it to me because I'm just going to want to cry again, you know? And he's like, he basically did the Pareto principle, the 80-20, on me in 5 minutes. And that just changed the way that I look at skill acquisition for everything I do in my life. That was so pivotal to have him explain, like, there's something called chords, and a chord is just basically any 3 notes, and there's billions of chords, there's billions of combinations, but if you just know 4 of them, you can play 200 songs. If you know 5 of them, you can play hundreds of songs, so just memorize these. And I was like, wow. And so I sat down and I obsessed over it, and then I actually learned how to play all these songs without looking or reading or anything like that, because I saw that they repeated. And then I started to have my own voice, right? Then I played Beatles and I played all these others. And then I started to really write songs and have my own voice and do this. And I thought, man, if I could have just quit for the rest of my life and I'd still be sitting here thinking like, music is, don't even try and explain it to me. You know how people say, I'm bad at music, I'm bad at language. That's part of the reason that I like doing the keynotes and the coaching, is because it's almost a version of like wanting to save people from themselves. Like, you think you're bad at music, so did I, right? And now I've got, I don't know, like 5 million people that listen to me every year, and I've got 60 million streams on Spotify or something like that, right? Like tens of millions. And I'm not famous, but it's just, it is out there and people tend to gravitate towards it despite my lack of education and credibility and me, you know, clearly saying I'm bad at music. So people say I'm bad at music and bad at math and bad at foreign language or whatever. I'm like, hold on. I don't think you've tried it.
Right.
I don't think you've given it a chance yet. You know.
Yeah.
So that kind of framework really helped me and apply it to multiple areas of my life and really help other people. And honestly, even in ways that are so far removed from music or foreign language or sports or anything, like healing from injuries, you can apply the same like 80-20 principle. I've had 4 surgeries before. I always heal on the top 1%.
That's amazing.
Of people healing and being able to do things in 2 weeks that's supposed to be week 12.
Right.
And all of it is that same framework that I can thank my friend when I was 17 for.
Yeah.
Right.
It's mindset. So
it really is.
It is. That's awesome. And now people can find you on Spotify.
That's right. Yeah. Pretty much anywhere. Yeah. Yeah. I always say anywhere music is downloaded, bought, sold, streamed, or stolen, that's where I am. So yeah,
Spotify.
Amazon, Spotify.
That's the big platform. Okay,
that's
cool.
It, yeah.
Amazing.
You know, one thing that you brought up earlier that I think, the framework that I use, I certainly use to try and get better at like kickboxing and Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu still. I mean, I've been doing it for 30 years, I think. And it's still, you know, frustrating and humbling.
Yes.
And everything, right? But And sometimes it's really frustrating because I know that I'm making progress like this, but I'm training with people half my age that are pro fighters that are making progress like this.
Yeah.
And so I don't see them for 2 weeks, and it's just like a huge, they're shutting down my whole game. And
yeah.
So it's, you know, it gets kind of frustrating like that. But in general, when you're trying to learn a skill like a sport versus a skill like speaking a language or, let's say, dance, right, or playing music or you know, something that you and your team and in your business are working on to make progress, mm-hmm. the big difference in a sport, especially like that, right, where it's like you lose at tennis, you lost at tennis, no big deal. You're tired. You go home. You say, I lost. You lose in Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu, like your arm hurts. I've had surgeries, like people are choking you out. It's like all that
your
stuff.
Your ego's bruised.
Yeah, everything's bruised, right?
Takes you right down to the mat.
But what's different about those things that I think people don't think about is that in sports, it's even more difficult, unless you're just naturally really good at it, or yeah. you're just a lunatic who's just thinking, obsessing about it every minute, and you really are getting better than everybody around you. But for the rest of us, it's like you have resistance,
yeah.
right? So you might be making progress, but you have resistance. If I'm going to learn how to speak Japanese and I try and I kind of mess up, people aren't going to try and say big words back to me that I won't know
sure.
to prove me wrong. We're not in competition. We're in, like, we're helping each other, right? Yeah. Like, we're trying to have a shared understanding. If we're dancing, I'm not trying to make you look bad.
Right.
This is not a judo throw. It's like, I'm trying to make the woman look good. That's yeah. my job. And her right. job is to do... We're cooperating. And so even though you can apply the framework to sports, and I definitely do, and I'm always thinking of ways of like, man, how can I leverage my strengths when I'm with somebody who's bigger, stronger, heavier, better than me? Like, what's the best I can do here? I'm going to leverage those things. It's you just have to recognize that it's easier to feel like you're making progress in an area of your life when there's nothing against you. No one's going against you. No one's trying to swat the chicken and broccoli out of your hand.
Right.
They're actually probably like applauding you for that. And then it's an upward spiral. So mm-hmm. the better you get, the more you see that the abs coming in, the more you want to eat healthy, the yeah. more you enjoy eating healthy, the more, right?
But then everything tastes better.
Everything does. Yeah. It's just like the process is even better.
Yes.
And that's kind of the tough part too. And that, you know, as trite and cliche as this wisdom is of saying like, you know, it's the journey, not the destination. There is some aspect of it where I think, this is why I say progress equals fulfillment or mm-hmm. fulfillment equals progress. Because even though I'm not as good at anything that I do that as I want to be. So it doesn't matter which thing we're talking about, right? Like I got a scholarship to play tennis in college. I still play. I don't play as much as I used to. I want to get better. I want to at least maintain and be better. I don't right. have to be the best. I don't right. have to be better than everybody I play with. But I don't want it to go down, right? It's just that feeling like I'm making progress instead of just the destination of like there is no top of the mountain, right?
That's like how I feel about jiu-jitsu. It's yeah, just an ever-evolving
There's one
journey.
Person who's the best in the world, and everyone else
sure.
is, and that person won't be the best in the world for very long, probably. Right. But there's literally one human, if there is a best. And then that's it.
Yeah.
So everyone else, it's like, you kind of have to enjoy the journey with all the bumps and stuff, knowing and feeling like you are making progress.
Yeah.
But the truth is, you're never there. You always think, like, I'm going to sell my business and have all the money I need and travel, and then I'll be there, and that's going to last a week.
I find pleasure you know? In the process.
Yeah.
So, like,
right.
that's something that I've always enjoyed is learning something new and enjoying it for what it is. And it's really, like, the, you know, when you've started a business, so you know, like, when you start, you have a finish line that you see. I think when you first start, until you start going through the process and everything organically unfolds before you, and then you just kind of fall in love with the process. You don't mm-hmm. ever want to see the finish line.
Yeah.
You just
right.
kind of just, it yeah. dissipates.
Yeah.
And so that's where I started associating that with every practice in my life was mm. like, I really don't want to see the finish line.
Yeah.
I just like the growth.
Right.
I like the spiritual growth, the mental yeah. growth, and the physical growth of it all.
Yeah. It and that's the other thing. That's a good point is that I, like, even I look at my career as you know, as you know, I do many things, so it's hard for me to answer the question, what do you do?
You're like jack of all trades, master of yourself.
I don't know if I'd go that far, but yeah. Definitely jack of many trades. But you know, it's just hard for me to say like this is what I do. But that feeling of getting better in each area and feeling progress in every area really is kind of the thing that drives me. Like, there's a finish line, but you're right, I don't want to get there either. And I get fulfillment out of, it's like when I write a song, let's say, right? I'm already getting fulfillment out of writing the song, even if I'm like, this isn't great, I'm going to redo it, I got to rewrite the bridge, I'm going to do it in a different key. I'm obsessing over it. Nobody knows how it's supposed to go.
Right.
And I might throw it away, I never know. But then it's out there, and then, you know, if it's a number one hit or nothing happens, you know, if three people email me and say, that cover song you did of XYZ, like, that's the best version I've heard. I didn't even like the song before I heard yours.
Yeah.
That I get some creative fulfillment out of that because I know I've evoked an emotion out of somebody else that I put this labor of love into. Or when I craft something that I think is funny and people are going to relate to and I do get a laugh, mm-hmm. or I craft something that I think is a kind of a deep, profound message that's poetic and it's in music, and it lands, and I can tell that it lands because, you know, strangers tell me or email me and say, you know, can we have permission to use your song in this movie or whatever it is? Like, you know, it's not like, okay, I'm there. It's like, yeah, this is the kind of thing that gives me fulfillment. It's the reason that I do it. But there is no there for me.
Right.
I'll keep doing it whether everyone stops listening to
continuously
my music today.
Honing your craft.
Yeah, just getting better. And yeah, exactly.
It's more about the art of it and getting lost in the process.
Yeah, cool. Yeah. And I also think in terms of like, because my career really isn't, I don't think of it in terms of jobs, I think of it in terms of projects. So some of them are ongoing projects for years, some of them are short term. It's like, I'm going to give a keynote on this date, it's going to be an hour long, and then that one is done.
Yeah.
People ask me to, you know, perform or do something for a charity, and I go through this checklist of like, okay, am I really going to have an impact being there, or could it just be anybody? Am I going to work with smart people? Are they going to raise more money because I'm involved in it? I have this whole checklist. But really, one of the things I think about, if it's a longer-term project, is even if this thing that I think is a good idea ends up failing financially, let's say, like I have this business idea and I try it and it's one of my colossal failures, what is the upside from that in terms of like what relationships will I have established even in failure? Who will I become despite failure, yeah. right? And so just having that as a guide makes me think like even there kind of is no such thing as failure. Like it's everything is a test. I kind of look at everything as a test, right? This is a test.
Yeah.
I didn't fail. I tried this, thought it might be a good idea. I had all these reasons. I justified it in my head. I talked to a few people. Then I just did it. And then I found out for some reason that I didn't think of or some reason that I did think of but didn't give enough, you know, weight to. I was wrong. Mm-hmm. Okay, like next test. It's not like,
right.
What was me?
On to the next.
Right.
Yeah.
So.
No, I appreciate that. I respect that. That's great. You mentioned charity. Talk a little bit about the charities that you get involved with.
Yeah. So I've written songs for charity and then donated it to them and showed them how to collect the money for it. Whenever someone downloads or streams or whatever.
That's fantastic.
I'm personally involved with an organization called FAR Therapeutic Arts and Therapy. And they're in Birmingham, but they have a few locations in Metro Detroit. My good friend Pam Ayers runs that and does a great job. And that is, that's a charity that provides music, art, and dance therapy for special needs community. And
yeah.
One thing that's interesting, I always find myself wanting to say children because there are a lot of children, but there's also adults. And
right.
It's one of the few charities that works in this area that doesn't just kick you out and put you on your own when you're 18.
Yeah.
They have 40 and 50-year-old members that come there. And the transformations that I've seen in people are are just incredible. There's
that is a beautiful experience, and I'm connected with FAR too. Also, yeah, I've volunteered with FAR with some adults that have included me in some of their events, and it's a beautiful experience. I love that. I love your participation in that. It's fantastic.
Thank you.
Yeah, that's been an ongoing relationship with you and FAR for years now.
Probably 10 years. So I'm on the advisory board now, and I'll perform in their shows. And,
congratulations.
And one of them. Thank you. Well, one of them. I want to congratulate Leo Palmer. He's one of the young men that's been part of the FAR program for many years. And I've just watched him grow up. I think he's 19, 20 now. But when he was younger, he was, I'm not sure what the right word is. He certainly had social anxiety and probably still has a certain amount of that. But I'll never forget the first time he came up on stage in front of 500 people, just hiding behind his dad. I mean, this is a big deal. Again, like most adults don't want to do this, right? So here's a kid, and we had to tell everyone, like, when he's done singing, like, don't clap, just go like this. We don't want to overwhelm him with the noise. But there wasn't a dry eye in the room. This kid went from kind of being nonverbal to singing in front of 500 people. And then, so you see that transformation. It's not just like, yes, he's a great singer, but I've seen him grow up. He is a man now.
Yeah.
Like, he is a 20-year-old man who stands up straight and tells jokes.
Wow.
And, like, you know, is so we were on a TV show that they did about him, and there's a song that I wrote called In My Shoes about kind of getting to an age where you accept your imperfections and you're still going to improve, but you're kind of comfortable with who you are.
Yeah.
It's called In My Shoes, Comfortable In My Shoes. And Leo thought that I wrote it for FAR, for the charity. So he said, I want to sing this song. And I was like, okay. So now we call it Leo's song. So he's sang this song in front of, you know, with me backing him up in several places. And we did it on TV and stuff. And
that's great.
It was great. And
where
that's
can
amazing
listeners find
too.
That song? Where can they download that?
I'm sure I have a link to it on steveacho.com, on my website. But yeah, if you look up FAR Therapy, and that was on PBS.
Cool.
So they did a whole special on them and interviewed Pam, the president. And it was great. Yeah. So just to see something like that, to see the transformation of one person go from, you know, that level of social anxiety that just most of us don't appreciate. We might have anxiety, we might be anxious, but not to the degree where it's completely derailing of our lives.
Yeah, debilitating.
To be able to sing in front of people, to have that transform you into, now he has a job, like he has a real job that he goes to every day. That's not something most people are able to do, right? Without kind of the right intervention. So I love the work that they do. It's great.
That's huge. Wow. So you have an open door policy. So everyone's kind of welcome into the Steve Acho world of coaching and friendship, I suppose.
Absolutely.
Yeah, that's great. I love Leo's story. That's
like-minded. Fantastic. People with good intentions that are ambitious, I would say,
That's fantastic. Well, those are great hallmarks for a coach, you know. So in the coaching industry right now, it is, you know, it's, what is the word I'm looking for? It's saturated, oversaturated.
Yeah.
It's very oversaturated in that industry right now. And so I think that your uniqueness is what sets you apart, you know.
Yeah. And you're right that it's saturated. And I think the reason I still, even though it probably means something different to different people, and there's probably baggage associated with the word coach, I know when I hear life coach, I cringe a little bit, but there's some great people out there that
I know some great life coaches also. Yeah. So I don't want to demean anybody.
I'm not demeaning the profession,
Agreed.
Just the word.
Yeah.
Makes me think of a 22-year-old girl who's going to tell a 50-year-old man how he should live his life.
Right.
And hasn't lived much of her life. So it just has, I have this baggage associated with it, right?
Sure.
It's just like, you know, it's kind of the same thing. I believe that there are people that, I don't know if they're psychic or what the word is, but they seem to have some ability or sensory perception that I can't explain. Mm-hmm. I don't know what it is. But so I think there's something more than what I know. But I don't think everyone on the other end of a 1-900 number is one of those people. So
Absolutely.
It's kind of the same thing, right?
Kind
There's
of a
some great love coach. Like,
right.
Yeah, exactly.
Yes.
Exactly. So so when I think of coaching, the reason I like the word coaching as opposed to teaching, right, is because if you think of a teacher, like you go to school and they're like, this is geometry. Mm-hmm. Like you either learn what a hypotenuse is or you don't. You either can tell the attributes of it or you can't. It's like there's a right and wrong way to do it, right? Yeah. I'm going to teach you how to play piano. Like, there's a right and a wrong way to do it. But I think when you're a coach, you really think of like a boxing coach or a wrestling coach or a tennis coach or whatever. They don't even have to be great at the skill. Like, you know, I don't know that there are many piano teachers that don't know how to play piano. Probably not. They probably wouldn't be very credible, right? But I would bet that whoever the best basketball coach in the world is right now is not a phenomenal basketball player.
Right.
I bet whoever the best boxing coach is wouldn't stand up to the number 500 boxer in the world, right? They're coaching because their ability to use all of the attributes and experience and intelligence and education that they have and start with you. It's like, I think of teachers teach material.
Yeah.
Coaches inspire people to leverage their own strengths to be the best version of themselves.
Absolutely.
And so it's like, if I'm the coach, I'm going to look at you and I'm not going to say, I'm going to teach you, I don't know, pick a subject. Like, I'm going to teach you to speak Japanese. It's like, what do you want to be able to do? Do you want to learn writing? Do you want to be a UN translator?
Mm-hmm.
No, I want to be able to have conversations because I'm dating a girl who's Japanese and her parents don't speak English. Like, great. That's such great context.
Yeah.
I'm going to coach you on how to go about that,
mm-hmm.
given your language background, your understanding of the culture. Like, where are you right now, as opposed to someone else who wants to learn Japanese but for a different reason? Then I would put them on a different path. So I like the idea of coaching because it really is like, let's take that individual and say, you're this way. You have these innate strengths that I don't even have. You should use that.
And it's customized, right? And you're just helping polish people.
Exactly. It has to be customized.
Exactly.
Right?
It's a customized approach to people's individual uniqueness and then kind of just helping them hone their craft, polish their skills, and they already have all the tools.
Sure.
Sometimes you just need a mentor or a coach to help you pull it
out. To bring them
out.
Yeah. And that's, I mean, there's so much value to that, I think. I mean, I think one of the good things about having a therapist or a psychologist or a mentor or somebody just to talk about your problems with is, yes, of course, they've got the education and they can point things out. But even if they couldn't, just the fact that there's another human there,
mm-hmm.
that you get to talk to and be vulnerable with and safe and not feel judged, even if they don't say anything, there's value in that.
Yeah.
Even if they just, you know, do the typical, like, how did that make you feel? Well, what should you have done? What would you do next time? How long are you going to keep doing that for? Like, literally just pair it back to you and hold a mirror up. There's so much value in that before they even add anything.
Yeah.
That's why things like journaling and meditation are almost the same thing.
It's like a no-demands presence.
There you go.
You know,
yeah.
Sometimes you just need to hear yourself verbalize.
Right.
And
right.
You can figure out that, you know, that next step for yourself.
So I look at everyone as a coach. Like, I look at my accountant as a coach. I look at a doctor as more of a consultant than a doctor. Like, it's my body. I'm going to do whatever I think is right.
Oh, we have the
you
same
know
thing
more than me,
yes,
for sure.
Medically.
So I'm going to ask my questions, but
you
are a consultant to me, right?
Absolutely.
So I might ask 10 doctors and I might ask 10 non-doctors, but all of them are consultants who certainly know more than me, but I'm going to gather that evidence, you know?
Yeah.
So that's how I think about coaching, why I like it. What do you think? What is the stigma, do you think, of, like, when you say it's saturated, it's just like everyone's a coach for, like, what do you think of when you think of the coaching industry?
It's a pretty broad market right now.
Yeah.
So everybody's coaching something different. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? So I just see a lot of wellness coaches, life coaching. I mean, and I know a lot of folks in that industry.
Sure.
And I know some great ones.
Yep.
And then
yeah.
I know some toxic ones. And so, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's just like in every industry, there's just people that don't probably have enough life experience, perhaps, to be marketing themselves in that capacity.
Sure.
You know, I think that you have to be quite a well-rounded person with plenty of life experience under your belt to be able to speak from experience.
Yeah.
I think
I
that's
agree.
Probably the number
that's
one.
That's why the 22-year-old girl thing is
right
in my head. Because I actually heard someone say that one time, and she was complaining that, you know, when she puts up some cliche meme on Facebook, she doesn't get any likes, but when she puts a bikini picture up, she gets a bunch of light.
Sure.
And I was like, you didn't notice that this is how the world works? You're a life coach? Like,
I think that that's a very big title to have. I think it's very important. And if someone's signing up, you know, to work alongside you and they've trusted you as a mentor and a coach, that's a big responsibility.
I like mentor better. I almost think you should use the word life strategist.
Yeah.
Everything is just strategy, really.
Sure.
It's just like, let's start with
your own personal life strategy.
Your personal life, right?
Yeah.
It's like you could just start with, someone could say, you know, I'm about to go into medical school and I'm just terrified and I'm not going to have a social life for the next however many years. And I would just back up and say, why are you going to medical school?
Yeah.
Well, you know, my parents really want me to be, why do they want that? Well, they think it's a, you know, AI is not going to take that job and they really want what's best for me. And then, but do you want to go to medical school? Right. And you just start asking these questions of people. That's strategy. That's like, if the strategy is that you want to make your parents proud, maybe go back to your parents and say, I recognize that you want me to do this because you think it's the best for me. And you want me to have a secure future. Are there any other possible ways that you can help me do that? You know more than me. You're my parents. I love you. I appreciate that you want the best for me. This doesn't seem like something I'm going to want to do, and I'm not inspired to do. So are there any other ways on the planet that you can think of, or is medical school the only one?
Yeah.
Just the ability to hold a mirror up to someone and have them recognize that. What is the value of spending tens of thousands of dollars and a dozen years of your life doing something that you hate,
right,
versus having a strategist say, why are you doing that?
Then you're going to be spending thousands of dollars in therapy to figure out right, why you did that
why
in the
did
first
I do
place.
It? Yeah,
yes.
Right. Why didn't you just get a life coach or a
exactly.
strategist way back then?
Find a mentor,
right,
figure
right.
yourself out.
Yeah. So that's, I just think of it as, it really is just strategy, right? Like it's like, what are the outcomes that you want and why? That's the first
blueprint.
Question.
Yeah.
And then the strategy and then the tactics.
Yeah.
The tactics are what everyone wants, right? They're like, how do I use social media to get more likes or email subscribers or whatever? It's like, why do you want more email subscribers? Well, because, you know, if I get more followers, I'm going to sell my book. And it's like, just any follower? Like, what's your book about? If your book's about gardening, do you just want anyone?
Right.
Or do you want people that love gardening?
Exactly.
Get 50 of them, right? Like outcome, strategy, and tactics, you know, backwards.
It's a good blueprint. Yeah.
I think so.
I like
it. It's high level, but, you know. Yeah. There's a lot of ways to, I think, simplify frameworks that, not to trivialize them and make them seem like they're not difficult, because they are. They're hard to do, but, you know, I'll give you an example of one way to simplify complexity. So if you go on Amazon and you search for sales and marketing books, last time I did it was like 86,000 books, okay? There's great info. I use Amazon. I read books all the time. I read summaries. But the truth is, there's three ways to make more revenue. There's only three. You know what they are?
Give them to me.
You get past customers to buy again. You get current customers to spend more, and you find new customers. Everything you do, whether you're Apple Inc. or a one-person consulting company, is some detail of one of these, right? So then you start thinking backwards. So what are the systems that I have in place to reacclaim past customers? What are the systems I have in place in order to get current customers to spend more? Like, what other offerings can I, what other value can I provide? What systems do I have in place as a funnel for new people to come in, for new customers, so that I can sell them and put them into this? Now, what I just said is a huge oversimplification of the sales process, and I'm not trying to trivialize it, but it does help to simplify it and be able to back up and think about it that way, because it gets you out of tactic land right away.
Yeah.
Because someone will come with tactics and say, should I use social media? And it's like, let's back up.
Mm-hmm.
You've got this product that you sell. There's only three ways to, you know, you've got some customers, right? So who are they, and how do you profile and duplicate the perfect customer? The three ways, right? There's things like surveys. Like when you do surveys, when I do a concert or a keynote or whatever, anything, any kind of performance, and I want actionable feedback on that, I have found that there are two questions that people will answer and that are useful and that allow me to improve every single time I do it. I could ask you after this, right? The two questions are, what did you like most and what would you change, right? And if you tell me that every time I'm on stage and doing something, I'm going to learn from it because I find that I'm always surprised by what people like the most, mm-hmm. right? Or what, like, I'll write funny songs, and the song that I think is funny is, you know, gets a laugh.
Sure.
And then the song that I think is full of dad jokes,
yeah.
people are just like, whoa, like it's the most requested thing. And I'm kind of rolling my eyes like, this is like a dad joke, but who am I to say, right?
Right.
So I've been surprised by the things that have been like the biggest mic drop lines when I'm coaching, or people will repeat it 4 years later.
Well, I think there's two key components too, and that is consistency and relationship building in business. And I think that you've got that nailed down. Mm-hmm. And that scenario that you just gave right there is being consistent and listening, followed by relationship building with mm-hmm. your audience and your customer base.
Sure.
I mean, that's key.
Right but there. You have to be some version of what you rightly called lunatic, like us before, because the truth is not, like, everyone wants to get better or get healthier or be better, but not everyone's ambitious.
Right.
And so you can ask those questions and then do nothing, right? But I actually am, you know, I hope that I am better today as a podcast guest than I was on my last podcast. And I hope that the next one that I do is better than that. I don't have to be the best in the world. I'm not going to compare myself to whoever's, you know, Rogan's next guest is. It's like, it doesn't matter. Right. But just that yardstick for me and for us to be ambitious and ask those questions. But the original point is just being able to like back up and simplify whatever it is that you want to do makes it more approachable. Like even the 80-20. The example I use in 80-20 is imagine being a Chinese person, right? Grow up in China, never took English lessons. You're 20 some years old. Now you're going to move to some city that doesn't have a lot of Chinese people. So you're going to have to learn English. There are 250,000 words in the English language, in the dictionary, if you count all the derivatives and tenses, 250,000 words. People like you and I, who have, you know, been around for decades and English is our first language and have advanced degrees and have businesses and communicate for a living, only use about 1,000 words mm-hmm. out of 250,000. So just take that, forget English and all its complexities and pronunciation. That person that finds out that there are 250,000 words, how much less daunting is it to know that with a mere hundreds of words, you're going to sound like me?
Yeah.
I can pretty much articulate just about anything I'm thinking, and that's me. I'm a native English speaker.
Yeah.
If you had dozens of the right words and phrases, you're going to be like a natural, like it already makes it less daunting, and then you get into the how-to, right? So that's why I like simplifying.
Something that interesting.
That's the hack.
As I was growing up, I always had little side hustles through my neighborhood, and I used to do some work for my neighbor who was from Okinawa, and she was learning how to read the English language.
Yeah.
And so we connected via comic books. So I had comic books, and that's what she was using how to read. So we would swap, and then
that's
we had
such
that.
A great way
yeah.
to learn.
Yeah. Yeah. yeah, it was interesting. I was just like 10 years old at the time, and she was, you know, a grown woman, but trying to find her way, you know,
that's so great,
and learn the language. So that's interesting. She was simplifying it by going with comic books.
Yeah,
that worked for her.
And that honestly, that is something that I suggest to everyone. I've talked to some people who were moving to Japan, and because they wanted to, not because like their company told them they had to. So they wanted to. So they're already kind of some version of like what they call Japanophiles.
Yeah,
and they may be into comic books, or they may be into judo, or some other aspect of it. And I always say, like if you want to learn to read and you want to learn the vocabulary and stuff, like, you're going to get it through osmosis. And I can tell you, like, how to get more out of it and how to keep notes, mm-hmm. right, on the things that keep coming up, and how to actually use 15 minutes a day of training, not learning, not memorizing, but training means speaking out loud, mm-hmm. the things that you're highly likely going to have to say or hear in the next 48 hours. But outside of that, for the learning and for, like, getting more in, take the thing that you're passionate about. If it's comic books, take comic books and learn the language through that. Because if you pick up the Financial Times, like the Keizai Shimbun, like if you're bored reading the Financial Times in English, what do you think that's going to be like in Japanese?
Sure,
right?
Of course.
You're not going to really want to get through that. But if you love comic books, or you love like swordsmanship, or you love ikebana, or you love any of the Japanese like arts, whatever you're into. Mm-hmm. What a great way to have regular exposure to that while you're learning. It's like almost an excuse to learn it while you're playing, you're doing something that is your, you know, kind of after school or after work stuff you'd be doing anyways, right?
Absolutely, yeah. Yeah, back to our key word of the day, lunatic. I think
that's the key word.
I've been called a lot of names. Yeah. And so some of them are, like, when I get into something, I know people like to say I have an addictive personality. Yeah. So, like, if I'm jumping out of planes, like, yeah. Now I'm jumping out of planes.
You can
now
say
I'm,
passionate, too.
Right. I like passionate, but I think when people like to put a label like addictive, think that there's, you throw a word like addiction around, and people can be addicted to a lot of different things, like gossip in the drive-through,
yeah.
And processed foods, and you know what I mean, other things rather than just having an obsessive personality.
Yeah.
And you know what I'm saying?
I don't think that's the right use of the word. I mean, despite the fact that it's kind of offensive to people that are actually addicts and have gone through some bad
things. I
think
so too.
But the real definition of addiction isn't that you keep eating fast food. It's that the absence of fast food actually causes you problems. If you're a heroin addict and you stop using heroin, if you're a true alcoholic and you stop drinking alcohol, you could die. Like that.
I just
like
had this conversation the other day.
Right?
Yeah, absolutely.
So to say like you're an addict because you love the speed of speedboats and jumping out of planes, like, it's totally misuse of the word. It's like,
I agree.
You're passionate and you're, I think you could say obsessive. I was certainly obsessive about learning Billy Joel songs.
Well, the obsession comes
by
with
ear.
Your personal development and
right.
your professional growth and all the things that are tied to obsessive.
Yeah.
You know,
it's deep interest, and therefore, I mean, there's no question that Elon Musk is obsessive, but I wouldn't call him an addict. I mean, I don't know him personally, but
sure.
Like, I don't think I would describe him that way. I just think he's obsessively about, like, he's got this brilliant idea in his head of this planet's not always going to be habitable. I don't know when it's going to be, but it's not probably not.
Yeah.
Here's the trajectory we're on. We're going to get 1 million people to Mars by some date, and like, he's just not letting that go, and he
right.
hasn't let it go
yeah.
since he first said it, right? So it's like, you can admire that, right? Like
yeah.
that's those are the kinds of things that progress humanity, right? As opposed to the people who are like, oh, just do the bare minimum and be average.
Well, you know? Steve, I appreciate your lunacy.
So that's exactly why we get along.
Yes.
So I guess it is the word of the day.
Absolutely. So if any of our fellow lunatics out there want to find you, where would they find you
yeah.
at?
Well, luckily I have an easy name, Steve Acho, A-C-H-O, and I think you could just Google me or whatever thing you're using and you'll find me. But steveacho.com is kind of my digital business card.
Which is a fantastic website. I've been to it. It's great.
Thank you.
It looks great.
Appreciate it.
Yes. Any social media handles?
Yeah, I'm on, I use LinkedIn a lot for professional use and Facebook for personal and some music and Instagram. But I'm not a very responsible user of social media, we'll say. So I'm on it and occasionally, but I don't really use it to share my personal life. Like,
sure.
Hey, my buddy Mike and I are out eating burgers, and here's pictures of the burgers. Nothing against that.
But the best,
I just don't do
the
that.
Best contact for you is email, probably via your website.
Yep.
Okay,
yep,
perfect.
Just through my website.
So
yep.
If anybody
Steve
was
Acho.
Looking for a great keynote coach or
a keynote
the,
speech.
Yes.
Even. Yeah.
Micro business coaching, any of those things,
absolutely.
That, any of the services that you offer, there's a full array listed on the website, and that's where the folks can find you.
Yes, sir.
Well,
thank
Steve,
you.
Thank you for coming out today to the studio.
Hey, loved it.
Yeah.
Love the show.
It was a great episode. We're going to have you back as a recurring character.
I'd love to. Let's see what our fellow lunatics say.
I'm in. Let's do it. All right, guys. Thanks for joining us today. And that's a wrap.